By God, I have had this Congress. For 10 years, King George and his Parliament have gulled, cullied, and diddled these colonies, and still this Congress refuses to grant any of my proposals on independence, even so much as the courtesy of open debate. Good God, what in hell are they waiting for?
Sit down, John! Sit down!
Say vote yes, vote yes, vote for independence.
Open up a window.
I say vote yes.
Sit down, John.
Vote for independence.
Someone open up a window.
No, 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 too many flies.
Consider yourselves fortunate that you have John Adams to abuse, for no sane man would tolerate it!
John, you're a bore. We've heard this before. Now for God's sake, John, sit down!
I say vote yes,
no.
Vote yes,
no.
Vote for independence sake.
Someone ought to open up a window.
I say vote yes,
sit down, John.
Vote for independence sake.
Well, that'll start things off. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable as we get ready for the 4th of July weekend, America 250, and hearing from the musical 1776, the musical about John Adams and the Declaration of Independence. Just heard Sit Down, John. We'll hear some selections from that Broadway classic 1776 as our bumper music this morning. Good morning, all. Welcome to the program for this Wednesday, the 1st of July. A delight to have you here. 15 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock, and we have a lot to talk about, and we have a great group to talk about all of these things. We had a busy day yesterday with all of the Supreme Court decisions, and we were juggling all of that. So, we have a little bit now, the dust has settled. We can talk a little bit more about all of those events and move on and talk about other things as well. We welcome your letters as always. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And just stay cool. Just stay cool, and hopefully you can do that, and we can be with you while you're just not getting hot. So let me introduce the group to you. Chris Gibson is here, writer, analyst, recently retired from the presidency of Siena College, a former New York congressman. His new book is The Spirit of Philadelphia. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, Joe. Doing great. Good to be with you.
And you have a new gig. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. As of June 15th, I'm also a senior fellow with the Hannah Arendt Center at Bard College, and will be a professor of practice, and I'll start teaching in January.
Well, that's great, because, you know, we had a meeting about 2 days ago, and we sat down, and we said, you know, we don't have enough people from Bard on the show.
You think?
Yeah, so that's good. That's fantastic. We're delighted. Congratulations.
Thanks so much. Very excited.
I know you told us that, but I'm thrilled that you're doing that, and so glad you're with us. So thank you very much. Former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association and a longtime editor of the Daily Gazette, Judy Patrick, is here. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning. You know, my new gig is fighting woodchucks and chipmunks and mice that are eating my garden. I have to say that I'm losing the battle.
Up until about 2 weeks ago, I was saying that I had not seen many woodchucks. and during the spring, I really didn't see any woodchucks, because normally we're just overrun with them. The last 2 weeks, they've sort of made up for it.
We are overrun with them.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all over the place. And my God, so many chipmunks.
Yeah, yes. And you know what? And one of the annoying things is they'll eat half a pea, you know, a sweet pea. They'll eat half and leave the other half. And I'm thinking, do I dare eat the other half of this? No.
No, leave it for the rabbits.
Yeah, I got those too.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say I am one of those, and I know I'm one of the few that feel this way. But
oh, like, here we go. You want them as a pet.
Yeah, I do. I love watching them. I love them going around. I feel like we're taking over their space, and it's the outdoors, and whatever we can do to keep them happy. And I don't know. So I try not to, you know, sometimes, like when they're eating, you know, they eat the side of your shed, you get a little.
Are you talking about chipmunks?
I'm really talking about any living creature.
Because if you're talking about chipmunks, you know, you could call Alvin. I'm showing my age now,
yes,
right?
No, Alvin.
Alvin and the chipmunks and Dave, the manager.
Yeah.
And they can maybe corral some for you.
I love them all over. Yeah, they're all over the place.
They're
but,
cute.
But we have a place on a lake, and when we go in, the lake house is up a little bit, and just when you pull in, there's just the scurry of all the creatures taking cover underneath the house, and so, that's fine.
Yeah,
that's
like, just as long as they're not chewing through the struts, you'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, we try, I love having them around. Hey, Libby Post is here. Good morning.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Political consultant, lobbyist, longtime panelist. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, let's get to what is happening in the world, and there is a lot, so we will get started, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome you to, again, to be a part of this. So there were a bunch of decisions yesterday, so we can sort of look at this in two ways. One is the decisions from yesterday and the takeaways from yesterday's decision, and then we can also look at the takeaways of the overall Supreme Court session because their time ended yesterday, and that session is done. So we'll sort of look at that as a whole as well. And there, again, a lot came out yesterday, and we'll look at that. Number one, birthright citizenship, and that was a case that was being closely watched. I don't know if it was huge in the sense of that it was a great surprise. I don't know that it was, but we know, of course, now more than we did. One big question loomed over the Supreme Court term from the outset: would the justices embrace President Donald Trump's efforts to vastly expand presidential power or check it? This from the Washington Post. At times during the term, Democrats lamented that the conservative majority was handing Trump almost the authority of a monarch. At other times, Trump lashed out at the justices for reining in his favorite policy. The truth lies somewhere between those extremes. The administration ran up an impressive string of victories on the court's emergency docket, allowing Trump, for the time being, to ban transgender troops from the military, get the Education Department free some foreign aid, and strip deportation procedures from hundreds of thousands of migrants while litigation plays out over those policies. The justices also blessed Trump's move to fire the heads of the independent agencies that Congress had sought to insulate from political influence. But the justices also rebuffed some of Trump's boldest and most controversial assertions of power. They struck down his sweeping tariffs, his executive order limiting birthright citizenship, his deployment of National Guard troops to Chicago, and his bid to exert greater control over the Federal Reserve. In the end, the court showed that it was willing to support a muscular view of presidential power as long as it was in keeping with longtime conservative legal goals. But that it would not accept some of the sweeping and novel assertions of authority that Trump sought. Judy.
Yeah, they threw a couple of they gave the They gave Trump a lot of what he wanted, but I think the birthright citizenship decision was part of their strategy to show the world, hey, we're not completely doing what Donald Trump wants us to do. We're gonna. It was, if anything, the fact that it wasn't a 9-0 decision gives you pause. And this issue is not dead. You could see the writings today. People are saying, this needs to go before Congress. We need to have a greater discussion about this. Congress needs to act to somehow add some provisions controlling what people perceive as unfettered citizenship. And so I think this is not a done issue at all. I think it was strange. Some of the Brett Kavanaugh analysis of it is the fact that it wasn't against the Constitution. This was against a congressional statute. And then that needs to be revised. I just think this whole notion of who is a citizen and how our country perceives who we want to be citizens is a discussion that we didn't used to have, but is one we are definitely going to have in the next, 2 years.
Chris Gibson.
Yeah, a general comment first is really about the arc of where our country's going, and then I'll move into some specific analysis about the courts and the decisions they've handed down. And I don't think it'll be surprising. I think some of the listeners know that in this latest book, I'm arguing that the founding principles, when you look at how we view ourselves as a species, human nature, and then how we then treat power. So I think what the founders did there was really genius. They recognized that we're conflicted. We have moments where humans are capable of extraordinary love, even sacrifice if we're called to it. But if we're being brutally honest, we have lesser angels in all of us. And so to best deal with that, the founders separated, checked power, kept it transparent and accountable. And they did this primarily through separating these and creating these separate branches who were meant to really share power. And I think that is setting aside all the baggage, the sins of the original founding documents, what they did when it came to understanding us and how to array power, I think are time-tested, and we have drifted from that. So I want to move now to the analysis on the courts. I do think in general, I agree with what Judy says here, that this is another, generally speaking now, this is a continued countenance or concurrence with the overall trend of centralization of power and in essentially putting it into the hands of one person out of 330 million Americans. We seem to, as a republic, we now are comfortable with one person making these decisions. This is not a new thing. It's, right. I mean, this phenomenon really started in the early part of the 20th century, but it's clearly accelerated. And the current president has pressed this to the boundaries where even the courts themselves seemed a bit surprised at just the audacity of some of the proposals. Now let's talk about the specific one mentioned here. And this has to do with birthright citizenship. So the Constitution is very clear. There are two general ways to propose amending the Constitution and two general ways to ratify those proposals. None of them include one person by executive fiat changing the Constitution. Doesn't matter what political party that they're in. It's not something they can consent to in their role as members of our Supreme Court. I am surprised it wasn't a 9-0 decision, and I'm taking note of that. 6-3 is a strong decision, but the fact is that we need to follow the process. And is that being pedantic? I mean, you could argue that. I don't think so. The reason why it's not pedantic, it's sincere and it's significant, is that the founders arrayed it that way that we would have to work together. What we were trying to avoid is the history of the world since time out of memory is the abuse that happens when tyrannical power accumulates into one person. So with regard to this decision, in this case, the court has said, no, you can't by executive order do this. What's surprising is that President Trump has done this several times. He has taken very bold action when had he taken more strategic and decisions on how to approach these decisions, he might have ended up with a different conclusion. But doing it by executive order was sure to fire away for him to be rejected.
Let me post.
Well, I'm sort of relieved by some of these decisions, the birthright decision being the biggest one. But, you know, there's the Statue of Liberty. There's this message that we want you to come here. And as I was telling everybody, last week we were in New York and we saw Ragtime at Lincoln Center. And it was all about immigration to this country. And I saw my grandparents in that musical because they came over on the boat. And people, what was so astounding about it was that people were doing standing ovations in the middle of the show because it was so visceral. And people felt what the songs were about in terms of American freedom were so clear, right? Because it deals with race, it deals with immigration, it deals with anti-Semitism, racism. And, you know, it was just really very moving to be there to watch this and then to realize, leave the theater and realize what we live in, right? Where Chris, you're right. He wants to be a tyrant. I think he sees himself as this authoritarian leader who can do whatever the hell he wants. The fact that he's made billions since being in office is one indication of that, where you have money and politics so intertwined that money is making all the decisions. It's not like that hasn't been the case in this country, but this is really just obscene. The other issue is what they've done over the course of this this term to LGBT rights in this country. You know, they say it's okay to do conversion therapy, where everyone else is saying, anyone with a brain who, you know, pays attention to science knows that conversion therapy is harmful to people, to LGBT people. They just banned transgender athletes from girls' sports. And it's a state by state. They're giving states the ability to make their decisions. So in New York, those folks are not going to be banned from girls' sports. But the thing is this. We are talking about a minute percentage of our population. And we are, the right is going bananas over this because it gives them that wedge issue like they had in 2000 for marriage. That's one of the ways that George Bush Jr. got elected, was using same-sex marriage and marriage equality as a wedge issue. They're doing the same thing here. You know, when they go nutso at the college level, there were 10 transgender athletes that the NCAA is knows about and is tracking. We're not dealing with this overwhelming flood, right? But yet, this court is going to allow states to bar transgender athletes from girls' sports. What about, so that what that's saying is, men, young men who go through the process and are transitioning to be women can't participate in girls' sports. What about the women who transition to be trans men, are they allowed to participate in sports? I mean, they don't say anything about that. And again, you know, I think a lot of people just don't understand this whole issue. They don't understand, especially for men wanting to transition to women, why they would give up their male privilege. And that, you know, then you have women who are transitioning to become men, and they're not even talked about in here. They're like not seen as a threat at all because they want to be men. They want to be part of what's seen as being part of a power structure. And that's not why people transition to go. They want to transition to live their true lives. And that's fully okay. It should not be an issue. It's not anybody's business. Just like who we sleep with isn't anybody's business. Who we share our lives with isn't anybody's business but our own. But this court, you know, has to give him something. And he has railed around transgender issues. He has railed about wanting to have total control. They're not, thankfully, they're not doing that. But when it comes to real people's lives, he's having an impact. And let me tell you, the birthright stuff, you're right, Judy, it's not over yet. It's far from over. We can only hope that the Dems take the House and the Senate and put major roadblocks up And thankfully, the story yesterday that Alito was retiring was not true, because that would have just, you know, put us all in a bullseye, because Trump would try to put one of his more right-leaning, more than Alito, right-leaning folks in coming from the Heritage Foundation.
You know, on the matter of immigration, I do want to put a finer point on some of the general comments I was making, perhaps more and perhaps some balance into the conversation here this morning. Yeah, look, I think that when you look at the intent of what we are endeavoring to do at the outset, we are, of course, a nation of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
We're also a nation of laws. And I do think there are some sensitive aspects of this issue that could be addressed, debated, discussed, possibly reformed in certain ways, so that we could strike a balance between the two, that we don't set up a moral hazard, and that we don't end up with undermining an overall approach of being a nation of laws. This is why I made that comment, that the way to do that is by addressing it from the people's representatives, not by executive order. By doing this by executive order, I'm not going to say he poisoned the well, because as was pointed out, this issue is going to continue. But it didn't do anything to advance the cause. If one wanted to question whether or not we have this balance between being a nation of immigrants and a nation of laws, this was precisely not the way to do it, by attempting to change the Constitution by executive order. This was never going to work. And so we'll see what the next play is. But I just want to make that point that, you know, as was mentioned in some of the media accounts yesterday, in fact, I saw a very, a careful and thoughtful way to address the topic on the NewsHour yesterday. There was an analyst there addressing the issue of birther tourism, the idea that people may want to come here, have a baby, have that baby, then have American citizenship. This analyst said, well, you know, there's actually ways to address that now, short of changing your interpretation of birthright citizenship, because the officials who meet at the border and go through processing for even a visa or for an entry, like we all do when we come back to the country, there is a way to raise some questions and find out if somebody is very late term in their pregnancy. And there are actually authorities now to really curtail, if not stop, birth tourism, if that's an issue. So you don't need to do a complete reinterpretation of the citizenship clause to do if that's your issue that you're going to deal with. That's an example of what I'm saying is there are ways we can have this conversation and look at ways that we can strike a balance. Okay.
Okay.
Meaning, but this will always be the debate, right? I mean, what we're just doing, like, this will go on. I mean, I think this is just what you were
saying. And on and on and on.
Right.
Right. Unless he's able to pack the court, but then we'll have to wait generations to change the court and correct these decisions. You know,
the consequence is if the court ever affirms that we can change our Constitution by executive fiat,
we're in trouble.
We would be in utter denial to say we're still a republic because, I mean, there are safeguards against this kind of consolidation. So I think we have to be very clear about that, that you just don't get to alter the Constitution by some executive order.
You know, the underlying problem here is the assumption that the only real Americans are people who are descended from those from the Mayflower, and that though people who are coming here and just having babies so they can, you know, suck away all the welfare benefits they can. I think that is the underlying hate that's driving this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss, and we'll do exactly that right after this.
Richard Henry Lee, Virginia is my home. My name is Richard Henry Lee, Virginia is my home. And may my horses turn to glue if I can't deliver up to you a resolution on independence. For I am FFB, the first family in the sovereign colony of Virginia.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Judy Patrick, Chris Gibson, and Libby Post with us. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I just real quick, because Libby reminded me of this, but there is the story within the story yesterday on birthright citizenship and the announcements that were made yesterday in the court. We were running a special from NPR, and then at the end of the special, right before they ended, and threw it back to us, Nina Totenberg came in and said, Samuel Alito is retiring. And then there was like a second of speculation, and then they went back to regular programming. Then we came back, and then I started to look, just as we were talking about this, trying to find more information, and I couldn't find any more information. And I said at the time that I'm sure this will all work out in a few minutes, but as of right now, no one else is reporting this, and I find that to be odd, that no one else is reporting this, because I assume they all get the same information if they're covering the court, that CNN or the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and the like. So there you go. So yesterday, it was within maybe 5 or 10 minutes, NPR retracted the story. Nina Totenberg had already written and by the way, a more eminent journalist when it comes to the covering of the Supreme Court for 5 decades, right. I can't think of anyone else, then to have this, have her report it, that you do tend to, you know, believe it. So they retracted the story. She had written in advance, had written a web story about the retirement. And once she reported it, then that went out. So that information went out as well, in addition to what was reported on the radio, and obviously sent newsrooms scrambling to confirm. The court quickly denied the reporting. Nina Totenberg was on All Things Considered yesterday and said an apology and said that it was a rookie mistake and that there was no one else to blame but herself. And she also wrote a letter to Justice Alito. And Totenberg said on the radio, I scared everybody half to death for about 5 minutes entirely on me. It's not anybody else's fault. And then she read the apology that she wrote to Justice Alito, who, as of this reading, has not responded, I believe, to Nina Totenberg. But and here was, and then I want to hear Judy's reaction,
yeah,
to this.
Me too.
Which is, she said, I rushed out of the courtroom after the opinion announcements, and when I realized that the usual rush of folks after a few minutes had not happened, I asked somebody what was going on inside, to which the answer was retirement announcements. I didn't hear the S on announcements, and I assume something no reporter should ever do, that you, Samuel Alito, were retiring. Later in the segment, Totenberg indicated that she hurried out of the courtroom to join NPR's special live coverage of the court's rulings. She said she should have stayed at the court to hear the substance of what was being announced.
You think? You know, I would argue that a rookie wouldn't have made that mistake. Rookies make sure that the information that they publish are true. Nina Totenberg has long been too close to the beat she covers. She has, you know, she considers some of the justices her friends. She has lunch with them. We talk about this on the Media Project. You really shouldn't be friends with the people you cover. This is totally a diss on her credibility. Rookies don't make mistakes like this. Big mistake.
The other thing I can't, if there is a bright side to this, it seems to me that, at least from my vantage point, everyone checked it out. Like, it didn't go further, which I thought was interesting.
Totally agree. It shows that the rest of the media is not going to go with just one source and just repeat. I mean, the danger would have been, according to NPR...
Well, that's what I expected. That's exactly what I expected.
But no, everybody else held off. So the kudos to the rest of the media. I guess... This is what I do when there's a big story. I usually do go to two sources to make sure it's really true, because nowadays you never know.
And I mean, we ran it on our air, and it, because it was
a live stream,
because we're NPR, a live stream, and I'm glad we noted at the time that, like, this has not been confirmed by anybody, so we're checking it, and I'm sure that we'll know. But boy.
Well, I'm just smiling because, you know, it reminds me of my experiences as an Army officer. We had this saying that the first report is often wrong. And so, you know, here you are, you're in the heat of battle, and you get a report. It could be mostly right. It could be entirely right, not always, not likely, but it also could be mostly wrong. So you're not turning yourself off to the report, you're just being skeptical because it's a first report and people are under fire. Their five senses could be altered because of that. Their heart rate's probably faster. There's a whole number of reasons as to why that first report may not be accurate. But the point is, it's a first report, and then you're waiting to see. So although very different in professions, there is a similar trend and principle, which is, let's take a second on this and just really take a look at it. So, yeah.
The other, go ahead. Did you want to say something?
No, I'm good.
The point is to be, you rather be right than first. And it's something that you have to drill into to reporters, because, you know, there's some sort of ego involved with being first. As first reported on NPR, I mean, you got to let go of that, because being right is the supreme goal here.
I was quickly corrected by our listeners that Vox and Bloomberg did pick up the story right after, but then took it down very quickly. So here's the other story, or here's the other aspect of the story that I think is worth a moment of conversation, and that is, so what do we do if he really was going to retire, like, tomorrow or today or in a week? How does that change things? And it just seems to be interesting, because there had been a lot of speculation that Alito, maybe even Thomas, would retire. Both, and especially Alito, had said that they wanted to see through the 2027. But I don't know. It's an interesting thing to see. Like, does that even calculate into, will that change an announcement perhaps that was going to come?
Right, because if the Senate changes hands at the end of this year, then the chances of replacing a conservative justice with another conservative justice considerably decline. So that's the same calculation that they made during the Obama administration, the Biden administration.
Right. And the other part of this is that even if they do it now, between now and the end of the year, there is no guarantee that the Republicans who Trump primaried and then lost in the Senate are going to go lockstep with the rest of the Republicans.
I don't know, though.
What do they have to lose? They've right now, they're already pushing back. Massey's pushing back. You know, I mean, what do they have to lose?
Trump proposes a respectable conservative, and Massey believes in conservative values, I think he might go for it rather than.
Yeah, and Massey also is in the House, but your point is well made. But, you know, I'm just thinking through as I was listening to both of you speak, and because I know Cassidy, we served together in the House before he moved to the Senate. Very thoughtful guy. But I have to say that even some of his decisions in the last year and a half has surprised me in relation to my experience with him. So I was trying to put myself in the place of trying to assess where Cassidy would come down on this. But I also realized that my information and analysis could be dated based on some of the decisions he made with regard to the nomination. So, the general comment that was just made that generally Republicans like somebody from the Federalist Society candidate mm-hmm. list, that's true. That's still mm-hmm. true. So, I don't think it's beyond the pale that they would, especially given, if you look at the analysis that came from Siena College's or Siena University's Research Institute as of yesterday, as far as the Senate being in play, those folks are – they're paying attention and, mm-hmm. and they know what's at stake. So to your point, Joe, I was thinking about all the possibilities about what could have led Nina to do this. Was he actually contemplating? Well, we think he's contemplating, but he had a timeline. But that's one of the that's one of the scenarios. There's other. There's yes. others. There's also the possibility somebody planted something just to get her to fish on that and to really discredit the mainstream media.
Well, there is that.
There's that. I mean, we don't know. I'm speculating. Yeah. But it does – the only reason why I'm bringing it up now, it's in the context of thinking through the scenarios that could be between now and really the election.
I want to read one more thing about this. Benjamin Mullen wrote this for the New York Times. The Totenberg's article. The article went through an extra layer of editing known at NPR as, quote, the backstop, according to two people familiar with the process. NPR added that layer in 2024 as a final line of defense against errors before publication. But because the article cited an announcement rather than confidential sources, the network did not take additional steps to verify the accuracy of the information. What I don't understand is, if you have a backstop, how does that not solve the problem?
Right, there are holes in the backstop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I imagine the resignations that they were talking about were probably just staff resignations,
yeah.
and the justices were saying goodbye to them, which would have been a common part of the end of the session, which Nina Totenberg should have recognized. Again, this is it's going to be a long way. Maybe the next retirement we will hear about will be someone from NPR.
Yeah, or Nina Totenberg, right? Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you mean him? Yes.
Yes, and I will say, this annoyed me, and I probably shouldn't bring it up, but I'm going to anyway. In the initial report, they said that NPR had confirmed this with Nina Totenberg's intern, and I was like, don't blame the intern,
right? Right.
For God's sakes, don't blame the intern.
And they need to take a harder look at their backstop, I think. Defenses are only as good as you originally make them. And if it only deals with anonymous sources, then it's not truly an effective backstop.
So all eyes were on the – I feel like we're doing the media project right now. I apologize. All eyes were on the court yesterday. I mean, practically every news outlet in the country had eyes on the court yesterday. So what happens when a reporter thinks they heard something and like all eyes aren't on the court? Like, we caught that really quick because all eyes were on the court. But what if ...
There's been almost a feeding frenzy on the coverage of the Supreme Court lately. And then when you get these decisions, you have interns grabbing them and running outside with them and giving them to, people who are on the air who are trying to digest 150-page reports as quickly as they can and send it out into the world. And yesterday I heard a couple of major missteps, and if you had turned away from that channel, you would have thought, birthright citizenship had been upheld. I mean, we're trying to go too quickly on the Supreme Court. And the other thing, I mean, the Supreme Court is a very important institution, but at some point, the coverage overwhelms everything else, and people tune out. So the idea that the birthright citizenship decision was given as much attention as it should have, especially the fact that it seemed like a give me. It's like, of course they're going to uphold birthright citizenship. We thought that when it was first proposed. I understand that over time people have started to worry that maybe this court really was going to throw it out with, the baby out with the bathwater. But again, I think the coverage at some point was so high that it was overwhelming the actual discussions of the issues. For example, let's have a real discussion about birthright citizenship. Why are we so worried about it? What is the actual impact of it? Let's talk about the transgender issue that we talk about, the fact that it's such a, you know, there are nuanced ways of dealing with the issue of transgender people in our in sports and work. Those kinds of discussions aren't being held because we're so interested in the political divide. Oh, this was a political decision. 6-3. We focus as too often on the politics of everything we do rather than the actual issues involved.
Yeah, I mean, so building on that, and Joe, responding directly to your question, what if we were had attention in another direction? So my take on that is that I think there's enough process that we wouldn't, as a country, make a major error because, I mean, obviously it's going to be months before anything that would happen in the wake of a retirement announcement. What is in play is something that's so vital to a republic, which is there's got to be trust in institutions, not only the governmental institutions, but actually the Fourth Estate and the role that it plays. So I'm encouraged and heartened to hear Judy take a hard line because she's a leader in the profession. And this is what the Army would do if it was something that has to do with the trust with the American people, with the institution of the Army. We would want leaders of the Army to speak out and to speak strongly for principles and for accountability. So it heartened me to hear you say that. I'd also say that so I think that's really what was most impacted yesterday was it was yet more grist for the mill that we shouldn't trust the mainstream media. And so in that regard, it's sort of a half step or a step backwards, or at least in the wrong direction of where we need to go to revitalize a republic, because we've got to, you know, the whole transparency thing that when I mentioned that doesn't just happen. The transparency happens through a median, and mostly that's done through the media. Not entirely. There's other ways that we get transparency, but the media plays a large role in that. So if we have an institution that's discredited, it weakens our republic.
We have letters. Mike writes and says, "Dear panel, I appreciate the show. If Trump gets another Supreme Court nominee, I will implore my representatives to simply refuse to accept nominations. There should be no reluctance to do that. Also, it's way past time to end lifetime appointments. It's apparent that they do not work." That from Mike. Then we go to Eric. "Chris Gibson was my member of Congress, and I desperately wanted him to run for governor. Well, now I want him to run for president. We need reasoned common sense in government. I'm wondering, does the panel think a constitutional amendment reversing Citizens United and also ending gerrymandering would ever have a chance of passing?"
So, yeah, first of all, I support both of those proposals that are raised here. What I've learned...
You're going to run for governor and president?
No, neither of those. No, I mean, look, we need reform. We are on the wrong arc when it comes to how we send representatives to Washington. There's a number of reasons why, but how we're apportioning and districts right now is one of the reasons, and there are others. So, I mean, I have been an advocate for independent redistricting. That is likely... and I say likely to need an there's actually some scenarios where you could do it through legislation, but you would then be vulnerable and they would be tested in the courts. But I think you still could win. Most of the avenues that I see to get to smarter, fairer district lines are done through a constitutional amendment. Here's one thing I've learned through experience, and it has to do with term limits now, but I want to use that as an example. So I think the way you could get term limits done, because, you know, we actually have them in states for legislators and in some cases governors. We actually have we have both of these. And of course, we have term limits for presidents at the at the federal level. We could get it for our legislators, too. But as is often pointed out, it's hard to imagine humans voting against their own interest. I think here's a way you could address that. You could say, and there is a precedent for what I'm going to say in statute, that you could pass a proposal that would go to the states for ratification that would say that that term limits shall be the law of our land and shall take effect when the next representative from the respective districts goes to Washington.
Yeah.
This would happen over a period of time. But when you vote, you are therefore not objective, so you are not impacted. This is, by the way, why we had the button down there. When I had my vote card, you had the green, the red, and then you had the abstain. The whole reason why they did the abstain button was if you were impacted by that, you were supposed to abstain. You're not supposed to vote on legislation that you could financially or otherwise benefit from. But, I mean, I think you could do this. You could actually draft an amendment to the Constitution that could pass. And I think over time we would have term limits. And I moderated on that issue. I'm now for 12 years instead of six. And I did that mostly because I listened to the experience in California. And they actually thought that they didn't get to take a step forward with the term limits at 6 years. It's a longer conversation. And I'm not saying that that's the only answer. But I'm bringing it up in the context of the gentleman or gentlelady that's bringing it up, because we clearly need reform in our republic.
Just one thing.
Yes.
Just one thing. The courts also yesterday, the court said parties can spend as much money as they want on campaigns, flipping the Nixonian decisions, because all those things were put into place after Nixon and Watergate. And so that just piggybacks on Citizens United, and now the party with the most money, and we know that's the Republican Party, is going to be able to pump millions and millions and millions of dollars into races at all levels.
So in the spirit of Philadelphia, I also come out for campaign finance reform. Yep. It absolutely – now, the way I go about that probably is controversial, I'm sure, is that I, having thought deeply about it, I think the way we need to do this is we need to prohibit all political action committees, period. So that's a – rather, you know, I realize it's a stark proposal, but this thing really breaks down. I've had these conversations with the right, the left, the right, and the problem is everybody wants their own pack, right? If you're on the left, you want the corporate packs gone, but you know, you want the union packs to stay. My dad was in a union. I have a vote record that supported collective bargaining, supported unions. I believe strongly in that philosophically, because I think you need a balance to management. I mean, I think it's part of this balance piece. But I think when it comes to campaign finance, it's clear we have money is the problem now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could cite you all kind of data about what's happened to the funding of these campaigns, almost all of which is bad. And so I do think if we prohibited political action committees and kept limits for individuals, we would take an enormous step forward.
We are late for a break, but great stuff. We'll continue our conversation after this short break.
All right, gentlemen, let's get on with it. Which of us will write our Declaration of Independence?
Mr. Adams, I say you should write it. To your legal mind and brilliance we defer.
Is that so? Well, if I'm the one to do it, they'll run their quill pens through it. I'm obnoxious and disliked, you know that, sir.
Yes, I know.
But I say you should write it, Franklin. Yes, you.
Hell no.
Yes, you, Dr. Franklin. You,
but,
you,
but,
you.
But, Mr. Adams, but, Mr. Adams, the things I write are only light extemporanea. I won't put politics on paper, it's a mania. So I refuse to use the pen in Pennsylvania.
What lyrics?
Pennsylvania, yeah, good stuff. 1776. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Always nice to have you with us. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. All right, let's move on to other things that are making news that I'd like to talk about this morning quite a bit. And we begin with, we continue, actually. So the House is going to recess early. The GOP rebellion over Trump's elections overhaul leads the House to recess for the 4th of July early. Disagreements among Republicans over the Save America Act, a priority for the president, have delayed action on a must-pass annual defense bill as well as other issues. So the House going home early for the holiday. After a failed attempt by House Speaker Mike Johnson to fulfill Trump's demands to advance the Save America Act, lawmakers are leaving right now, and they won't be back until mid-July. Johnson initially vowed to work in the coming days to bridge differences in the party over how to advance the elections legislation after a procedural vote failed, 224 to 198. It would have merged the Trump-backed Save America Act and the National Defense Authorization Act, a bond passage of the latter, and sent both bills together to the Senate. "We had some Republicans who decided that they didn't want to advance the rule this week," Johnson said to reporters. "What they did was they impeded and stopped the progress of the week. It is not helpful. We're moving really important legislation for the people, and we don't have time to waste." Let's go to the former congressman for his thoughts on what is happening here.
Well, look, this is another example of what I mentioned at the outset of my remarks this morning. Is this is really the atrophying of the founding principles that were put forward in our country. I mean, so, you know, without getting into all the details of how slavery impacted us, ultimately led to a civil war, that original sin really took that initial design. And, you know, when Lincoln was assassinated, we never really recovered it, even though he did have a vision to do just that. But I'm making this point to say that even with the monumental disagreements on slavery, the system that we had, if you discount that for a moment for the reason of this, of functionality, they were able to pass budgets. They were able to do so much other legislation, railroads, because they understood that this was part of a process that you had to work together or you kept the status quo. So the fundamental question is what's being proposed? Is it better than what we have right now? And it also came from a temperament knowing that you had to work together or else you had to keep the status quo. We're so far away from that right now. I have watched both political parties do this. Just most recently, you can think of when President Biden was in, how frustrated Democrats were at Manchin and Sinema. Oh, my gosh, Manchin and Sinema. I heard that a million and five times. And they're like, we got to get rid of this filibuster. You know, in fact, we're only going to put people forward in primaries who agree to get rid of the filibuster. OK, so that was the Democrats. What about Republicans? I can show you that they did the same thing. I watched I can mention to you names, but let me just say that these are leaders who said that they thought the filibuster was silly. We should get rid of it. And then I've watched it when during President Biden's time, they were like, oh, it's sacrosanct. You can't touch it. So, I mean, it's just no principle when it comes to this, when in fact, it's exactly the principle that really that crucible, that forcing function of having to work together is allows us to have a beautiful system that allows for a peaceful evolutionary change towards a better society. So, you know, where we are today, it's partly because of politics, obviously. It's mostly because of politics. But there's a belief in both parties that this will not change. This arc we're on will not change. So we're stuck with either a complete epic Republican victory or a complete epic Democratic victory. I don't believe that's true. If you look at the data last week that came out from CNN and then prior to that from the USA Today, you'll see that in these polls, half of the country now is identifying very upset, disaffected, and identifying as an independent. Whether or not that's true or not, but they at least told these pollsters that's how they feel. They felt if we had a serious candidate, you know, who came forward and had a reasonability and really a commitment to governing for all of us, I think that they would shake things up. That person, regardless, you know, I mean, whether they be a moderate Democrat or moderate Republican, but somebody who just said, look, enough, we're going to come together. I think it would be serious. And I say that as somebody who was frustrated at No Labels. You know, they told us they were going to put forward a candidate in 2024, and they didn't. Ultimately, they didn't do that. Now, there's a party, a new party, Andrew Yang and Christine Todd Whitman put this party forward. It's called the Forward Party. And I want to be clear, as a traditionalist, I'm still Republican, and I don't plan on changing that. I mean, it's just part of who I am. Haircut's short too, but I will tell you, that I think the Forward Party is part the pressuring they're putting on the system to reform is what we. I mean, that's helpful. So it's a they're a constructive force right now, and they're trying to get their act together so that they put forward candidates on the national level, and if they do. I think that you could see these press conferences that the speaker that he just gave, that would have to stop because there would be a competitive alternative to this perpetuation of this inane activity that ultimately leaves us without appropriations bills, without addressing immigration. We've long needed immigration reform. I mean, a whole host, including, by the way, the stockpile of our weaponry, because we just had this long conflict with Iran, and now as we look to deter, shape a rising China and deter Russia, I mean, the fact that we're down on so many of these munitions is not good for our deterrence. I mean, I'm just illustrating. These are just several issues. We could list dozens of them. And yet we have a Congress going home now because they couldn't seem to pass a rule that would somehow give to the Senate something that the Senate would never pass.
So with that said, I mean, we can say, well, they should stay in the Zen town, get the work done, the people. But if they stayed, would anything have gotten done?
I don't believe that, that they would. And it's partly because, you know, look, the speaker is also a human who's concerned about losing the support to be speaker. So there's only so much speakers will do. Because they're concerned that they'll be at any time. And I say any time. It's not like it was a couple of few years ago because they did change the rules to some degree that it takes more than just one person to actually force a vacate the chair. But it's not like dozens. I mean, this still can happen. So the speaker, on the one hand, is trying to move forward an agenda that he believes in. But at the same time, he's not going to do that at the expense where he could lose his support and lose his position. So that's just the House. And then, of course, the Senate, on the one hand, is trying to move forward agenda that they believe in. At the same time, they have a prerogative of protecting the rules of the Senate because they understand what their role is at the origin of the country, which is to sort of cool the tea, if you will. So that takes some comedy that, and I don't mean comedy. That's often yes. We get the comedy with the EDY instead of the ITY. But the point is that you had to work together. The Senate was certainly more known for doing that. So until we take structural reforms, and I list them all in this latest book that I published, but I believe that we're going to have reform. If we want functionality in our government, we're going to have to change the way we send people to Washington, the way they interact. These rules have to be modified because right now it's just not incentivized to do our work.
Libby.
Well, I agree with almost everything you said, but getting back to the issue here of this, of the bill, the two bills that they wanted to join together. I mean, this is the fact that Trump is saying they have to be joined shows that he has no regard really for the defense of this country. He knows that the other bill isn't going to go anywhere, but he's continuing this, oh, they have to be passed together in order for me to get what I want, which is a voting disrights act, really. I mean, you know, women, I mean, they're talking about bringing your original birth certificate. So, you know, I don't know if you changed your name, Judy, when you got married, right? Okay. So I can tell you what I find really amusing about the whole birth certificate thing is that lesbians won't have a problem because most of us haven't changed our last name, even if we got married. So, you know, there'll be a flow of lesbians at the voting booths if with our birth certificates showing our names. So, but the whole thing is just really another way for Trump and this ilk of Republicans to disenfranchise the biggest swath of people possible so that they can continue to get elected with minority vote, not people of color voting, but small amounts of people voting. And, you know, the SAVE Act is a solution in search of a problem. We all know there isn't voter fraud. We all know that. I mean, study after study after study has shown that there is no voter fraud. It's like minuscule, right? But no, no, it's because he lost against Biden. Everything was rigged. You know, I run campaigns. I didn't win every campaign on last week and primary day. Did I come out and say, oh, it was rigged because I didn't win my races? No. This is the people spoke, and you just have to deal with it, right? And be an adult, which is something we don't have in the White House right now. We do not have an adult. We have an 80-year-old man who acts like a 4-year-old child, maybe 3. You know, at 4, maybe a little more discerning. I'm not sure. But it's really just the whole thing is bizarre.
Judy Patrick.
You know, I commend Libby for focusing on the issue, and I would tell her that I've looked in vain for my birth certificate. I don't know where it is. But I look at this from my work ethic and a PR perspective. First of all, once again, Congress is going home. If anything, Mike Johnson is gaining support among his members because they get another vacation. They're not working. How many times have I sat before this microphone and bemoaned the fact that they're not there? Right. I'd make them sit in their seats until it was time to go home. And
whether they like it or not.
And then from a PR perspective, I mean, are they incredibly tone deaf around America? The polls, the primary results are showing that people are unhappy with the dysfunction in Washington. And this is a clear example of that. I mean, I want them in Washington and working. The fact that he's giving them an easy out. Go home. You know, enjoy yourselves for the next, 3 or 4 weeks. And then you're going to come back for a short amount of time. And then it's campaign season. So this just gives them more time to campaign. Campaigning is not representing your constituents. It's not doing the hard work of being a congressperson. So work harder. This should be a full-time job for you. I wish I had that schedule when I was in
the
workforce.
I just want to say a couple things on this. Perhaps just a bit of other points of view anyways. And that is that some ways analogous to the immigration issue, I do think there are some things that could be done to enhance the trust of the elections. Look, I'm not here to debate, you know, all this. I see your points. I'm not even saying that that's an issue. But we know that if you have to have an identification card for any number of things, and yet we say how sacred we view our democracy and you don't need an identification card, it's not a good look. I'm just saying it's not. I mean, I understand partisan-wise, if you're on the left, you say, no, it is a good look. And if you're on the right, you say it isn't. I'm trying to say objectively, it's not a good look. I mean, if you need an ID card to get on a plane, you need an ID card to, or at least a library card, which needs an ID card to get it beforehand to take out a book, we can do this. I have said in the past that there should be an American identification card. It's something that we're all proud of. I mean, that was something we'd all share, whether you're a billionaire or a trillionaire, or if you're somebody just trying to work your way up the socioeconomic ladder, we would have that same leavening card. It should come at no cost. You shouldn't have to pay for it. I mean, right now, if you get a driver's license or a passport, you're paying. And for some mm-hmm. working class people, that price is even very difficult for them, the choices that they're making when it comes to putting food on the table. But I'm really just making a larger point that it's just illustrative that we get broken down on solvable problems and we think that they're intractable. But, you know, so this issue with NDAA, with the National Defense Authorization Act, I mean, essentially this is an age-old political trick or approach, which is we're going to use it as a cudgel. We haven't missed a National Defense Authorization Act now in over 60 years. For all our dysfunction we've had in our government, my goodness, a lot. We've passed an NDAA every single year for the last 60 plus years. So the idea of using it as a cudgel, I can see why somebody's trying to do it, especially given the need, as I mentioned, for munitions. And you certainly want to pay your service members, including an increase. So then trying to tack this onto it, I could see. But the Senate has made it clear. This doesn't even have 50 votes, much less the 60 that's needed. So we're wasting our time. And this is really just supporting Johnson in terms of him keeping that position. But you know, the last thing I want to say on this is that, again, you see this kind of activity that seems inane to us from leadership, regardless of what party's in control, it's because they think we have no choice. And that's where I'm saying that even as a Republican, I think the forward party's playing a constructive role because it's trying to pressure the system. If you look at our history, there have been times when third party movements have forced the parties to face the realities that they did not want to face. And it did cause change. So, you know, that's my analysis to this. And so it is slightly different, I think, from the other panelists. I believe that I'm even not really in step with most of the listeners when it comes to those. But I felt like integrity forces me to bring that point forward.
You know,
we honor integrity.
Yes, we do. And most of us have the real ID because you had to get it, right, in order to get a license.
But you paid for that.
Yeah,
some
sure.
People
I know.
Can't
I know.
Afford that.
I know. I understand that, but. But the other part, from my perspective, you go to the polls, the poll workers are the same people you see year after year after year, for the most part, and you have to match your signature. And your signature is right on the screen, and you have to sign your name. And if your signature doesn't look like a facsimile of what's on the screen for them to look at, you don't get to vote. You get an affidavit ballot or something like that. So, I mean, I get what you're saying, Chris, that it should be easy for everyone to get an ID and to show it. But the fact of the matter is that voter fraud is so minuscule. Why are we're only making this into an issue because this man, Donald Trump, says elections are rigged if he doesn't win, which is like, how could I not win? It's like I cannot lose. It's, you know, he has no concept.
I hear you on this, but here's when we have so many, when 40% of the country doesn't seem to change their, I mean, they're still strongly behind President Trump.
30.
So,
I would say 30.
All right, so maybe we'll call it somewhere in between that. But my point is that if we're concerned about the viability of our republic, and if we can take this issue off the table while helping working class people and get an identification card, which they could then get on an airplane, not that they would have the money necessarily right away to be able to do that. But right now, it's very difficult. If you're somebody and the other piece is that part of your description you gave, which I concur with, my experience, too. I know the people. But we live in rural communities, right? Yeah. In the city, yeah. I think of our son, Connor. You know, he doesn't have a drive. I mean, he has a driver's license because he got it, but he wouldn't need it. He takes mass transit everywhere.
Right.
So there are people who live in urban areas who don't have a driver's license, so they don't have this kind of identification. They should have it because it'd probably be helpful for them. And then the other piece is that at voting booths in the city, it's not the same as here. I'm saying we can take this issue off the table and actually provide an identification card that not only is helpful to people, but also is gives something we all have in common. And increasingly, that's something we don't have. We used to have when we had universal service or at least a draft, which I'm not advocating for the return of the draft. I'm saying that there were some common experiences that all Americans have, and that is fewer examples of that today.
I just caution that having an official ID from the government, and what happens if you don't have one, and, oh, I want to see your papers. That's what this harkens back to me, is Nazi Germany, I want to see your papers. And if you didn't have the right papers, you went to a camp and you were killed. You know, and so as somebody who's living through a time of anti-Semitism that I never, ever, ever thought I'd have to live through, somebody saying to me, I want to see your ID card because I want to see really who you are. Right. And I want to see if you fit in here and if you're the right person to be here. It's that part. The abuse of that is what scares me more than the fact that. That we should provide it to everybody. It's the abuse. And we know, we see it over and over and over again. You give people a little bit of power, you give them an inch, they take a yard,
not
the whole
trust
football
issue.
Field.
So I'm empathetic with what you're saying.
I'm going to pause you there on empathy.
Yeah.
I have empathy for your point of view. I want to give you full time to express it. So let's take a break, and we'll be back right after this.
It's a masterpiece, I say. They will cheer every word, every letter.
I wish I felt that way. I believe I can put it better. Now then attend, as friend to friend, our declaration committee. For us I see immortality in Philadelphia City. A farmer, a lawyer, and a sage, a bit gouty in the leg. You know it's quite bizarre to think that here we are, plain midwives to an egg.
Egg? What egg?
America, the birth of a new nation.
We're waiting for the chirp, chirp, chirp of an eaglet being born. Waiting for the chirp, chirp, chirp on this humid Monday morning in this congressional incubator. God knows the temperature's...
Good morning. Welcome back. Listening to 1776, the Broadway soundtrack. And kudos to Madeline Reynolds for putting all that together, our Broadway fan who gets to control the music and does a great job at that. I just want to remind you that coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, we'll present the third part of our We Still Hold These Truths, America at 250 series, part three of four. The fourth will be tomorrow. Today, we'll welcome historian Robert Parkinson about his book, Tyrants and Rogues, Understanding the Declaration of Independence, a fascinating conversation. And then also, Beau Breslin, our curator and Skidmore College constitutional scholar, will talk to Annette Gordon Reed, the Harvard historian and renowned Thomas Jefferson scholar, about race and Jefferson, and that will be coming up in our 11 o'clock hour tomorrow as we have our grand finale of this series. We'll talk about not this 250 years or the bicentennial. We will talk about the centennial and how our nation's founding was celebrated 100 years later. Also, we will welcome one of the best, as historians go, Ron Chernow. So, who will talk to us about George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and yes, Mark Twain. So, all of that coming up tomorrow on our series. Again, it's We Still Hold These Truths, America at 250. If you've missed any part of the series, you can find it online, wamc.org. Let's go to other stories. And I think like on a normal day, this would probably be our big story. So don't think that just because it took us a little while to get to it, that it's being buried, because that is certainly not the case at all. But I just wanted to give us some time where we have a few moments to discuss it in its entirety. The New York Times reporting that President Trump pulled in at least $2 billion after returning to the White House. The release of a mandatory financial disclosure for 2025 shows that the Trump family's holdings, particularly the president's crypto businesses, were stunningly lucrative. President Trump reaped a stunning windfall in his first year back in the White House, including about $1.4 billion from his family's cryptocurrency businesses, according to this filing. All told, the president pulled in at least $2.2 billion, a figure that includes other parts of his vast holdings, such as his real estate assets. That compares to a minimum of $622 million his enterprises pulled in for all of 2024 before he returned to the presidency. Let me just say that again. Total revenue reported in 2024, $622 million. Total revenue reported in 2025, at least $2.2 billion. One of the biggest hauls in 2025 came when an investment firm tied to the United Arab Emirates bought nearly half of the Trump family's main crypto company, World Liberty Financial, a transaction that blurred the line between foreign policy and private enterprise. Mr. Trump also collected hundreds of millions of dollars from sales of his Trump meme coin and World Liberty's sale of its own digital tokens. The results detailed in Mr. Trump's mandatory financial disclosure report and released on Tuesday pulled back the curtain on the president's business operations. His crypto ventures, the report shows, are now some of the most lucrative enterprises, a remarkable turnabout for a man who once slammed crypto as a haven for drug dealers and scammers.
Hey, the good news is at least he filed the report. and that's the only good news there. You know, in his first term, at least he made an effort to disassociate himself with the ongoing business of his companies. You know, he said he was putting the sons in charge of everything. This time, all bets are off. You know, and it's egregious. It's outrageous. It really cannot stand, but there's nothing to prevent this. I don't think there's anything illegal, and the Supreme Court has ruled that he can't be charged with anything really illegal anymore. My one takeaway from it from a media perspective was that it lists revenue he got from the settlements with ABC. And and I always thought those were structured as not outright gifts or money to him, but to his library. So that came as a bit of a surprise, because oftentimes he will do these things and he will say, oh, yeah, but it's not really going directly to me. It's going to the, you know, the coffers of this institution, right, or that institution. But it seemed clear from the disclosure form that money, as small as it was in comparison to the billions he's received from cryptocurrency, it did directly go into his coffers. And we're only 2 years into this. I mean, again, from
cha-ching, more money to be made, man.
You know, isn't it just a problem trying to manage all that money? I mean, I'm happy with what I have.
I like that you're happy with what you have. Libby, are you happy with what you have?
Relatively.
Yeah.
You know, but can you spell corruption? Because that's what this is. I mean, let's be honest. But
Judy makes the point, and I want to hear
Chris. What, that he can't be? Right.
Well,
that's corrupt, too.
I understand that, but corruption would mean an illegality, which does not seem to be the case.
Well, I don't know.
I'm just saying that seems to be the problem in the system, doesn't it?
Well, what, the definition of corruption with this administration? Yes, that is the problem.
That you are able to do such things without any consequences.
And that's right. And that's what brings us to, from my perspective, the corruption issue. And using foreign policy issues and relationships to make more money. I mean, it's like, and you've got, you know, Jared and that other guy off in the Middle East cutting deals, right? For the business.
Howard Lutnick.
Yeah, Lutnick. You know, cutting deals for the business. And look, 50 years ago, when Watergate happened, we had a strong belief in the integrity of journalism. The Washington Post was still owned by Katie Graham. They did their thing. Ben Bradley was there. You know, it was a great history of journalism, a great moment in the history of journalism. Now, this president has caused the American people to question the validity of independent journalism, right? And so, you know, I go back to, well, the media will bring this down. Well, the media is not going to bring this down, because the media is becoming that monopoly that Ben Bandigian warned us about 40 years ago in his book, Media Monopoly. And all we're seeing now is corporate media giving him a pass, right? Because they want to do these mergers and they don't want to get him angry so that the FCC doesn't say yes to the mergers. And now the Supreme Court has given him the ability to fire the head of the FCC and the FDA and all those other independent agencies. So is it illegal on the face of it because the Supreme Court said he can't break the law? Not really, but ethically and morally, is it illegal? Yes. Is what they're doing corruption and corrupt? Yes. I'm waiting for that 30%, Chris, who stays with him, to realize they're the ones who are ultimately getting screwed with their pants on. And I don't know, maybe I won't be back after that. But it's true.
You paint a picture, right. Libby. You paint a picture.
It's so absolutely true. It's his base that is being, that are losing their health care. They're losing aid to families with dependent children. They're losing all of this help that the government used to provide. And yet they think, well, he's making all this money. Maybe I will too. And we all know that's never going to happen.
So, first of all, I do want to echo Judy's initial comment, and that is I'm glad I live in a country where we can know this information, that there is a transparency requirement, and the fact that also he complied with it. So I do want to not whistle past that, because that is not always the case around the world. So, all right, so that's an up vote for transparency. As far as the look, it's, in my view, it's not a good look, but I also have come to realize I'm quirky in some ways, and particularly among my party, there are some people who really admire the fact that he, they perceive him as a very successful businessman who has worked and done very well. So, I mean, for my wife and I, particularly in the time I served in the Congress, I had no stocks, so we would not have any conflicts of interest in that score. And we also gave our pension back that we had earned from the Army, because we didn't want to double dip in the time that I served in Congress. But that's me, and people have looked at me like I was crazy for that. But so I do want to acknowledge that, and I also want to sort of say something I struggle with, which is this data that I mentioned earlier, the data on 49% of Americans now identifying as independents. That seems to be moving in the arc that would support reform, or at least pressure for reform. On the other hand, I also hit the real clear politics every single day, or at least almost every single day, and I have been surprised. From a Republic standpoint, disappointed that there is, it doesn't move. I'm here to tell you, over the last 60 days, the job approval for the president has stayed at 40%. It's moved from 40.1 to 40.7. I think it's 40.7 today, or 40.5. But with all the monumental actions that have taken place in the last 60 days, for that not to move at all. So, I find that when I compare that with the 49% who now identify as independents, I'm trying to figure out where are we? And, you know, maybe both things are true at once, that there is a very solidified group that they're not going to change their position on this. So if that's the case, and in fact, a fair number of those folks actually admire him for his – so then I look at him as a rational actor. Why would he change? Because I did see – an interview where he talked to this issue. And it actually falls along the lines of what Judy sketched. He basically says he thought he made a mistake in the first term, that he didn't use his office to advance his overall bottom line. And he had every intention of changing that in this 4 years.
His financial bottom line.
Yeah. I mean, because remember, we were talking about the hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and there was this back and forth whether or not he said, you know, all that's in the past. He now thinks it was a mistake for him to even be concerned. He thinks it's appropriate, I think possibly changed by the court decisions and the interpretations of the amulets clause. So, I mean, it is what it is. So, and I think that's your point too, Joe, is that it's not been found to be illegal. So then it's left for us to say, well, right. is that immoral? Is that a good look? And I think now we're back in the realm of politics where he feels comfortable because he feels that his support will not wane. I think for all of us, we should take a broader perspective on it, which is this really the best that we can do? And how where are we in terms of the way we array power in this country so that we can engender more trust? Because that, of all the data that I look at, the most concerning is the fact that, different from Watergate, when people had strong opinions about Nixon in both directions, there still was a lot of support for institutions. In fact, a lot of confidence and faith that we would recover, regardless of where you were on Nixon, that we would then have a better day coming. Nowadays, that isn't the case. So many Americans report that they have lost faith in our institutions and, to a large degree, the leaders on top of them. So we can't long survive as a republic in that condition. And this is all the more reason. I mean, it's part of the reason why I come on the show now is, you know, this is really where I view my role as somebody who reads a lot and thinks a lot about these things. I think that that the way our responsibilities as citizens now are to really pressure for reform. If we want to bequeath to our children and grandchildren the kind of possibilities that we had, we're going to have to do some work.
Let's pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up for this edition of the Roundtable Panel. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Is anybody there? Does anybody care? Does anybody see what I see? They want me to quit. They say, John, give up the fight. Still to England I say, good night, forever good night. For I have crossed the Rubicon. Let the bridge be burned behind me. Come what may, come what may. Commitment!
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 1st of July. We're in the second half of the year. Here we go. All downhill from here. All right. We have things to talk about in regards to, well, I guess one more story that we'll get in before we have to break for today. I have been intrigued by this story for a long time. I think it's an interesting story. I don't know what to make of this story, except that Tom Kaine, the congressman, has been missing for months. And missing in the sense that he has not reported to Congress. He has been out of pocket to his office and, of course, to his constituents. The New Jersey representative we were told that he was ill, but he was working on it. And but then, really, no explanation. And by the way, he's on the campaign trail. He's running, and that would seem, I think Libby would agree with this, that it's not great when you have a candidate who goes missing in the middle of a campaign.
There's only so far proxies can go.
That's right. So yesterday, he finally spoke out and said that his long absence had been due to a hospitalization to treat depression. Quote, several months ago, due to health concerns, I entered the hospital for some testing, he said in a short speech on the House floor during the first day on Capitol Hill since disappearing more than 100 days ago. I was given the diagnosis of depression, he said. He added, many people think it is feeling sad. It is so much more than that. It is physical. It is emotional. Until you would experience it yourself, it is hard to understand how powerful this illness can be. Mr. Kaine is 57 years old. He's seeking a third term in a competitive district and missed more than 100 votes since he was last seen in public in March. He broke his silence on Tuesday with formal remarks during a morning period of speeches that are delivered by lawmakers to a mostly empty House chamber. Mr. Kaine's reappearance was closely watched after months during which he and his staff had refused to disclose anything about where he was or what was keeping him away. Their silence built Tuesday's return into a major reveal after a prolonged cliffhanger. But unlike a news conference during which Mr. Kaine might have answered questions and diffused the considerable mystery that had risen around his whereabouts, the format of a floor speech allowed him to say only what he wanted to about his long absence, avoiding the questions that journalists and many of his own colleagues wanted to ask him.
I find the story interesting for many reasons, but I think in our very limited time together, I'm curious as to this question, which is when someone has an illness like depression, you obviously have to take care of yourself, but there is also what the people who elected you should know about this, and I don't know what that is. I don't know exactly what that is. It does seem like there was some concealing here, but from what I hear, there were people in his office that didn't know what was going on, and I guess I just ask these questions as to how people, I mean, we saw this with Senator Fetterman too, of how people who are going through illness such as mental illness and depression, of how that is dealt with, where they could potentially stay in their jobs, but also make it apparent to people of what they're going through.
You know, I understand I respect his need for privacy and to deal with a mental condition. But in this media environment, the silence just amplified the speculation to the extent it shouldn't have been amplified. And he handled it the way he wants to handle it. I mean, I agree with you, Joe, that he has some obligation to his constituents, but were constituent services being continued? I think the office was still open, so there was that piece of it. As a crisis management perspective, I would have handled it differently. Mm-hmm. I think most people would have. But again, it's his life and his job. As a member of Congress, he sets his own hours, his own, you know, take a vacation.
Well, not that long.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm glad he sought help and take him at his word that he feels he's doing better. And I think that's, and the fact that he has spoken out, I think, it has the potential to be helpful to all of us. It's no secret to anyone that, you know, right now we are having a crisis of meaning. There's so many issues we're having in this country, mostly focused today on the collective aspects, you know, how we organize political life. But the reality is that so many Americans report high levels of isolation, mm-hmm. Alienation, and despair. I mean, look, the human condition always has this challenge, but I actually think it's one of the downsides of the Enlightenment. I'm mostly a fan of what we did in the Enlightenment, but I think the overemphasis on the line, angle, precision, the use of formulas, and the empiricism, I think, de-emphasized the fact of the mystery of life. I mean, we are still mind, body, and spirit, and I think to the extent that we don't acknowledge that, we don't sate the soul, and I'm not— for me, it's God, but it's not God for everybody. It's just it's a sense of mystery about our existence. And I think that that has contributed to the challenges. I also think the onset of the information age has also created enormous challenges for humanity in terms of trying to find meaning in life. Jonathan Haidt has documented so much of this in The Anxious Generation,
yes,
for Gen Z, but it's not just Gen Z, evidently. I mean, we know this, but now it's even acute when we look at Keem. As to what it means for politics, well, I guess there's this saying, we're going to test that hypothesis,
we'll
right?
Find
I mean,
out.
We're going to find out. But I will say it is a contrast compared to when I was a young boy. And I remember the 72 leading candidate in the Democratic mm-hmm, side, mm-hmm. Ed Muskie,
right,
who was considered a very strong candidate. And when he spoke of when it was revealed or outed, if you will, that he had had electric shock therapy, his response was very emotional. He cried that day, and his campaign ended, essentially.
Right.
So we are a different people today. I think there's more empathy for the challenges of this, but how it actually mediates through politics. And it's actually a decent case because it is a contested district. So it'll
right.
be curious to see how this goes.
Right. And I don't think he'll get reelected.
He
should have gotten out in front of this from a crisis management point of view right from the start. And he's deceived the voters. So,
also, and real quick, we're desperately late on time, but right. But also of whether even his personal decision of whether this is the best thing to go on and continue this line of work. My thanks to Judy Patrick, Chris Gibson, and Libby Post. You are all so thoughtful and wonderful. I appreciate you being here together. We are going to take a break. When we come back, our series, part 3.